You're listening to the RUF at UT podcast.
You're never so bad
that you're beyond the reach of God's grace. And you are never so good
that you're beyond the need of God's grace.
For more information, go to www.utk.ruf.org.
Turn your attention to a reading from God's Word in 1 Samuel 24, 1 through 22. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all of Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterward David's heart struck him, because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My Lord the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And so some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, 'Out of the wicked comes wickedness,' but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog, after a flea. May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." As soon as David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, and that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." And David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold.
We're going through the life of David in RUF this semester, and basically trying to figure out, what does it look like to have an ordinary spiritual life? What is ordinary spirituality anyway? And tonight we're going to come up to a topic that's very ordinary and very common to all of us, regardless of what you think or where you are spiritually, and it's the issue of temptation. And as I was preparing for this this week, I was reminded of a story that I'd heard a couple of years ago that took place in the area that's now Belgium, but it was in the 14th century. And the story goes like this. There was this duke that was kind of the lord of this region. His name was Reynald, R-A-Y-N-A-L-D. And he had a younger brother that mounted this revolt and overthrew his older brother's reign and kind of took power. And what he did with his older brother is that he put him in a prison, a cell, a room. And this room was very weird. The cell was very odd because it didn't have a lock on the door to it. And the younger brother told the older brother, "You are free to leave this cell anytime you want. And when you step out, when you walk through that door, you can reclaim your title, you can reclaim your position, you get your liberty back, and you're free to walk through anytime you want." The problem was, the door to this particular jail cell was incredibly narrow, and Reynald, the older brother, was incredibly overweight. And there was no way he was going to slide through that door on his own. So all he had to do to win back his freedom and to win back his kingship is just to lose weight while he's in prison, which would be normally very easy because you're given these meager portions. And instead, the younger brother only gave the older brother like rich, fatty junk food to eat. I mean, this is like a scene out of Saw or something, just like torturing this guy. So like all he has to do is say no. Here's a plate of Belgium donuts. No. Here's a free tub of ice cream on the house. No. All he had to do was keep saying no, and he would lose weight, and he would be able to step out and get his kingdom back. But he didn't, and he ate, and he ate in a prison without a lock on the door for 10 years. And I think we can probably relate to that at some level, maybe not the psychological torture of that, but at least the idea that we have these things in our life that we're extremely tempted by, and we know in our head if we just say no, if we resist whatever this thing is that we're tempted to do, we will have a life that is free, we will have the power and the control back in our life, but in the moment the temptation comes and it's so strong that we keep giving in. And we indulge ourselves, and then we hate ourselves for the fact that we indulge ourselves. And we're in prison to our own desires. And so the question I want to try to answer with you tonight is how can we say no? How can we resist the temptations that are in all of our lives? And to get at this, I want to look at this under three different headings. I want to look at the place of temptation, the pull of temptation, and then the power to overcome it. The place, the pull, the power. Perhaps, possibly, we should start. Let's look at the place of temptation. By the way, just to cite my sources, I'm getting a lot of help tonight from one of my fellow RUF campus minister friends, Brian Sorgan Fry, campus minister at the Mississippi States. And so shout out to him. So first, let's look at the place of temptation. If you look in verse 1, David is on the run still from the present king of Israel named Saul. Saul is hunting him down systematically, and we find out that he's gathered an army of 3,000 elite special forces, 3,000 men that are chasing David down like a dog. And it says in verse 1, this is very important, look at where David is. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Now, just because of where we are geographically in the country, when you and I hear the word wilderness, we think, and the image in our mind is like the Smoky Mountains. We picture David running through, there's this lush green, there's trees, there's moss-covered rocks, there's these beautiful streams, and we picture David with like hiking boots on, he's got his camel back, and he's got Cliff Bars and an Eno, and that's not the wilderness that David is in. David is in a dry, rocky, mountainy, arid desert. And he has no food and he has no water. He has no protection. He's got a couple of friends with him. There's wild animals in the wilderness. There are 3,000 Marines that are hunting him down, trying to kill him. This is the wilderness that he's in. And it's going to be in the place of the wilderness that his temptation will hit him the most, the strongest. And in fact, that's a common theme that you're going to see all throughout the Bible. The Bible always is associating wilderness and temptation. You have the people of Israel, they've been rescued out of Egypt, and God sends them into the wilderness for 40 years of temptation. Elijah gets tempted in the desert, in the wilderness. Jesus himself tempted by Satan in the wilderness. And so here's the question, why does the Bible from beginning to end seem to equate these two or associate these two things together? Wilderness, temptation. And here's why, I think. Because the wilderness is when you're in the wilderness, you're desperate. You have no access to what you need. You're insecure. Your future is unstable. And the reason why you're most tempted in a wilderness is because you'll do anything to get out. You'll do anything to make the pain stop. Desperate, lonely, rejected, insecure, unstable, overwhelmed, stressed out. You'll do anything almost to get out of the wilderness. And that's why temptation hits so strongly in the place of the wilderness. I mean, think about it in your own life. You maybe feel, you have a day where you feel fat, or you feel ugly, or you feel like your clothes are outdated, you can't, you know, whatever, and you are tempted to buy something or to eat something because that promises a temporary pleasure to make the pain stop. It's an escape. Or you feel bored, you feel lonely, you feel rejected, you feel isolated, and so you're tempted to look at porn. Or you're tempted to drink too much and find somebody to make out with. Because that will please you for just a moment to make the pain stop for a little bit. Or in your classes, you feel stupid, you feel behind, you feel not as competent as the rest of the people in your classroom, and you're tempted to just study your brains out. You're like, I will just go as hard as I can to pull myself out of this hole. And that temptation to be strong and in control again gets you out of this feeling of suffering. It gets you out of the pain. You know, I don't know if you've seen the musical Hamilton. I've seen it a number of times, and if you're remotely familiar with the storyline at all, there's a song in the second act that hits on all of these themes, right? You've got Alexander Hamilton, who is stressed out of his mind because he's trying to get this financial plan through Congress. He's overwhelmed. His wife is away. He's vulnerable. He's overworked. Here's the first couple lines of that song. He says, "I hadn't slept in a week. I was weak. I was awake. You never see a bastard orphan more in need of a break." And at this point in his life, the wilderness, he's vulnerable, he's stressed out, he's overwhelmed, he's lonely. Woman comes and knocks on the door, asks for money. She asks him to escort her back to her place, and on the way she tells him about her husband, how her husband's awful, and he's away on business, and so she invites him inside, and then she throws herself at him sexually. And then the chorus is him praying, and him just praying over and over, "Lord, show me how to say no to this. Show me how to say no to this." Right? He's just saying, I gotta say no. But the temptation is so strong. Why is it so strong? Because in that moment, he's in the wilderness. And this promises a temporary escape. If I can just say no, though, but he can't. And he gives in. And it introduces all of this damage into his family and all of this damage into his career. And so here's the question for you. Do you know what it is about you yet that when you're in that place, when you're in the wilderness, do you know what you run to habitually soothe yourself? I mean, all of us have different things that we run to. But it's in those moments that you're in the wilderness, that will be the thing that, whatever that thing is for you that you're tempted to soothe yourself with, spikes in its draw and its attraction. For some of you, it's porn. For some of you, it's alcohol. For some of you, it's sex. It's Netflix. It's shopping. It's eating. It's cutting. It's cleaning. It's working out. I don't know. Whatever it is for you, you have something that when you're in the wilderness, it is an incredibly powerful temptation. That's the place of temptation. Let's look at the pull of it. What is it about these things? Why are they so attractive? Why do they pull us to themselves? Well, look at verse 3. Here we see David and his crew. They're hiding in a cave, which is fun. And Saul happens to go into that cave as well, and he's by himself. And I think this is a really hilarious scene, if you didn't pick up on it when Margaret Rose was reading it. You have David and all of his men, probably with their backs up against the wall in the dark, holding their breath so they don't sneeze. And here comes Saul by himself that goes into that particular cave to use the restroom. And he sits down and he's taking care of business. And here's all of David and his men just watching him, trying not to make a sound or be caught. And in that moment, look at verse 4. All the men with David, they whisper to him, "Hey, this is the day that the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Here's what they're saying. Look, God has promised that you're going to be the next king, and here is this guy that's been systematically trying to kill you, and it looks like God has just gift-wrapped him on a plate for you. All you have to do is kill him. He's by himself. He's completely vulnerable. His pants are down. He can't stop you. This is the moment. Take him out. And you have to kind of pause and realize how weighty and strong this temptation would have been. Because think about it. It looks like God has opened up a door for David. Looks like God has just kind of put Saul on a silver platter for David. And all David has to do is plunge his sword through Saul, and here's what happens. David's suffering instantly ends. He no longer has to be on the run in the wilderness. He gets to claim the throne. He gets to be king and get all the comfort and the riches and the power that he was promised. And it would have been a better move for the nation of Israel. I mean, Saul was a horrible king. David would have been a good king. Even his friends are like endorsing this and encouraging this. There's a million good reasons why David should do this one little act of disobedience. If you kill him, just kill your enemy. You get yourself out of the wilderness. No more suffering. Instant goodness. And that's the pull of temptation. The pull of temptation is when disobedience makes sense. When it rationally sounds like it's a good idea. When your friends encourage it. Your friends don't see any problem with it. When it promises you benefits. This makes the suffering stop. This makes the pain stop. Just do it. It's not that big of a deal. It makes sense. That's the pull of temptation. So for you, it may look like this. You may think to yourself, look, I know that God is calling me to be a nurse. I love what I'm studying. I'm good at what I'm studying. This week has been crazy, though, and I have that test this week. And if I bomb that test, then I fail this class. And if I fail this class, my whole timetable of being a nurse is going to be totally screwed up. It's going to be totally thrown off. So I'm going to cheat just for this one test. And besides, it's not that big of a deal. Everybody is cheating anyway. And for the next test, I'm going to study extra hard so I don't have to do this again. And so you see what you're doing in your head. You're justifying and you're rationalizing disobedience. Because it's a good idea. The ends are good, even if the means are questionable. It might even sound godly to do that. And so we give in and we compromise. Or for you, it may look like, I know that God wants me to be married. It says in the Bible that it's not good for man or woman to be alone. God is pro-marriage. And I know I haven't had a ton of success in this area, but God's been really gracious to provide this guy, and he respects me and treats me well, and he's not like the other guys that I've met on this campus. So my friends aren't totally cool with our relationship just because I don't totally know if he's a Christian, but they don't know him like I do. He said he's willing to go to church with me sometimes. He said he's open to like talking about God. And so we know in our hearts this is not a good relationship that honors the Lord, and yet we justify it, we minimize it, and we give in. And we find ourselves in these relationships that aren't good. Or for you it may look like, God calls us to be salt and light. I know I'm supposed to be in the world but not of the world. And so, of course, like I'm going to go out on the weekends. And when I go out, I'm going to be with some friends. And they're not like, they don't get crazy wasted. Like, they're cool and they're fun. And it would be weird for me to go out with them and just not do what they do. Like, who goes out and then, like, doesn't drink and doesn't participate in what they're doing? I don't want to be seen as, like, weird and antisocial and, like, a crazy Jesus person that's, like, judging them. I don't want them to get the impression that I'm judging them. And so we give in. And we blend in and we look like the rest of the world. And we've justified it and rationalized it and even baptized it and said, I think God wants me to do this. That's the pull of temptation. It makes sense in the moment. It seems to make suffering go away. We don't want to look like a weirdo. Makes it go away. We don't want to be lonely, so it makes it go away. You know, I heard this story a couple of years ago. It was the story about these two guys that were sent from their home city. I don't know which one it was. We'll just say it was Knoxville. They got sent from their corporate headquarters in Knoxville to go up to like the business's main location in New York City to do an internal audit for 2 weeks. So this company sends these two guys up to New York City, puts them up at this hotel, and they do this audit on their business for 2 weeks. And after the 2 weeks is up, the company in Knoxville, the sending company, gets a phone call from the hotel after these 2 weeks is up. And here's what the hotel was saying. On the last day of these two guys' stay in this hotel, the housekeeper walks into the room prematurely, and she sees that there were these suitcases open on their bed, And inside of these suitcases, stuffed to the brim, was like a mountain full of candy. Individually wrapped little pieces of candy. You know when you go to like a restaurant and they have that little bowl with like the peppermints at the end, and you grab like one or two, and maybe somebody in your group grabs like the 12, you know what I'm saying? Well, there were these baskets of mints, candy, in the hotel lobby, and so every single day they would walk through and they would just grab 12 and stuff their pockets, or they just take the bowl and put it in their pocket or whatever. And you would imagine how much candy they accumulated over the course of 2 weeks, like suitcases full. I don't know why they were taking the candy. Maybe they loved the candy. Maybe they wanted to bring it back to their kids. I don't know. But they were thinking in the moment, it's just candy. This is not a big deal. How much does candy cost this, like, fancy pants hotel in New York City? Probably nothing. And so what they said was not a big deal quickly became a very big deal, because they found themselves sitting across the table from their boss in Knoxville that looked at them and said, "You are fired." And they lost this like big corporate successful job for stealing candy. But you see, in the moment, it made sense. It's just candy, not a big deal. We'll just take some and bring it back home. But that's the way it always is. It's just porn. I'm not hurting anybody. It's just making out and messing around. We're not having sex. It's just whatever. And we minimize it, and we justify it, and we rationalize it because it makes sense. But have you ever had this moment where you look back on your life at something you've done in the past, and you say this phrase, "What was I thinking?" That's what you were thinking. This makes sense. But you're not thinking clearly, because that's the pull of temptation. It says disobedience will advantage you, and it makes sense. It makes suffering stop, so do it. So how do we get the power to overcome it? How do we get to say no to this? How do we do this? Assuming that we want to. Assuming that we want to say no to the temptations in our life. Because look at David. David overcomes this temptation. In verse 4, David makes his move on Saul, but as he gets closer, he restrains himself and only cuts off a little corner of his robe that Saul probably just draped on a rock next to him. And David goes back to his men, and he says in verse 6, "The Lord forbid that I should do this. God anointed this man to be the king right now. And even if he's a horrible person and a horrible king that's trying to kill me and all of us, that doesn't give me the right to kill him." And so Saul finishes up his business, exits the cave, and starts to walk off with the rest of his people. And David waits till he's far enough away, and then David steps to the opening of the cave, and he calls out after Saul. And Saul turns around, and David is holding the piece of the robe that he cut. And what does he say in verse 9 through 11? He says, "Look, Saul, I could have killed you. I got this close to you. This could have been your head I'm holding right now, but it's a piece of your robe. I'm not a threat to you. I am not going to hurt you. Stop chasing me. Stop trying to kill me." And then Saul looks at him and does this like overly dramatic response, where he's like, "Oh, David, you are such a more righteous person than I am. That you would return evil for good. That you would not harm me. You're going to be an amazing king. You're going to be a great king." And it looks like Saul has kind of come clean and like the fight's going to end. But if you notice at the very end, the very last verse, David and his men in verse 22, they go to a stronghold, meaning David does not trust Saul as far as he can throw him. He goes somewhere safe because he knows Saul is going to come after him again. And in fact, one chapter later, Saul comes after him again. So what do we see David doing in this situation? Instead of ending his own suffering by ending Saul's life, he spares Saul's life and brings about more suffering. You see what I'm saying? Instead of using his power to kill Saul, he uses his power to bless Saul. He obeys when it doesn't advantage him at all. In fact, it completely disadvantages him. More suffering, more time in the wilderness, more running for your life like a fugitive. That's what his obedience led him to. More pain, more hardship. And so here's the question. How does David get the power to do this? How does he say no to this? Who in the world would choose obedience and suffering as opposed to disobedience and comfort? Here's how David did that. The key is in verse 12 and in verse 15. Look at verse 12. It says, "May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. And look at verse 15. May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. David is saying, look, I am banking on the fact that God is going to judge both of us. Both of us are going to be before the courtroom of God, and based off of the verdict God gives us, that is what empowers me to say no. Now, think through the logic of that. That makes zero sense if the verdict that David is expecting to get from God is that you are guilty and I will punish you forever. That does not compel any obedience whatsoever. David rather knows, and he is convinced, that the verdict that God has given him over his life is that you are innocent, maybe even righteous. In other words, David is absolutely convinced that the judge of the universe is for him, that he loves him, that he is out for his good. And for David, the logic is, if I know that, if I know that the king and the judge of the universe is for me, that is enough. I don't need comfort. I don't need riches. I don't need safety. I don't need luxury. I don't need popularity. I can give it all away because I have him. That's what empowers David to overcome his temptation. God is enough for me. I can give everything else away. You remember the plot to the first Shrek movie? Of course you do. We all watched it yesterday together. Princess Fiona is trapped in this castle guarded by a dragon, and she has this spell that's put over her. And the story is, if she gets a kiss from her true love, the spell will break. And so, as the story unfolds, Shrek and Donkey go to this castle and save Princess Fiona, rescue her from the castle, and when she sees and discovers that it's Shrek, she's angry. She's disappointed. Because in her mind, her expectation was, I'm supposed to be rescued by Prince Charming, and when he loves me and kisses me, the spell will break. You're just like a disgusting ogre. Take me back to the castle so that the prince can rescue me. She's so obsessed with this thing. I must have the prince love me. I must have the prince's love. He must be the one that kisses me. And then as the story unfolds, of course, when you get to the end, spoiler alert, she discovers that her true love is Shrek all along. And it's his love and it's his kiss that breaks the spell. And once she knows that she has Shrek, her true love, how does she feel about the prince now? Totally doesn't care. Thinks this is unfulfilling, thinks this is stupid, thinks it's a waste of time. You see what happened in her heart? That's what happens in all of our hearts. Whatever you most supremely love, it replaces and displaces everything else. So something that you had to have before gets replaced by a new love and a new affection, and you're free to give it away. David knew and was so confident over the verdict of his life that God was for him, his love was enough, that he was free to give away his comfort, his pleasure, his riches, his kingship. So how does that work for us? How can we be confident of the verdict and the love of God for us so that we can overcome our temptations? Here's how you can do it. Centuries after this story, David's like great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, Jesus, finds himself in a wilderness as well. And he's been without food or shelter for 40 days. And it's at that point, the place of temptation, that Satan comes to him. And Satan looks at him and says, hey, if you just bow down and worship me, I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth. You get everything if you just worship me. Now, you need to know, Jesus had already been promised by God the Father, you will inherit everything. And the way that you inherit everything is that you go through the cross. So Satan is saying to him, look, I can give you what you already want. And I can do it in such a way where you can bypass that whole suffering thing. All you do is have to say yes to me, say no to that, and you get instant comfort, instant pleasure. And Jesus looks at him, and in the point, in the most fiercest moment of temptation, says no. And his obedience sends him down a road of rejection, of loneliness, of torture, of betrayal. Here's what Philippians 2 puts it. He became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Why in the world would Jesus choose obedience and suffering and pain and loneliness and being forsaken by God on a cross instead of instant gratification, the way out? instant comfort. Here's why. Because Jesus knew the only way that you could get the verdict of innocent is if he got the verdict of guilty in your place. And so Jesus takes all of our sin, all the times that we've screwed up, all the times that we've given in to temptation, all of our weak faith, all of our failed promises, and he puts it on himself. And he goes before the courtroom of God, and God gives him what we deserve, punishment on a cross. And then we get what he deserves for his obedience. We get the blessing that Jesus earned through his obedience, and he gets the curse that we deserve through our disobedience. This is the great exchange that the Bible talks about. The cross is the demonstration that God is for you, that God loves you, that God is committed to you. And here's how this works in your head. When it goes from your head and stops being just a theological idea, but actually trickles into your heart, you can say, God is enough for me. Jesus is enough for me. He is so for me. The only person in the universe that matters, loves me, and is working everything out according to his will for my good, I can trust him. What I lose in this life, comfort, social status, money, whatever, pleasure, what I lose in this life pales in comparison to the riches that I get in him. He is enough. When that becomes your heart's beat, that is the thing that will power you, empower you to overcome your temptation and to say no to it. Here's how Titus chapter 2 in the New Testament puts it. Listen to this language. Titus 2:11 says, "For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people. It," meaning the grace of God, "teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age." So, how can you say no to the temptations in your life that are going to bombard you tonight and the rest of this week? You drink deeply of the grace of God for you in Jesus. You see that he gave himself for you, and that means that he is for you. You are his. He is yours. That is enough. Will you believe that? Will you come to God and say, I don't really believe that. These other things that I'm so tempted to run to, I think those will be the things that really fill me. Will you convince me afresh, God, that you are enough? Because deep down, I don't really believe it. The way that you say no to your temptations is when you drink deeply of his grace. Consider an invitation for you to do tonight. Let me pray. Father, give us eyes to see Jesus crucified for sinners like us. And would that flood our hearts with an awareness and a conviction and a confidence that you love us and you're for us. And if we have you, then we can give everything else away. Come disaster, scorn, or pain. Come the wilderness. Come pain and suffering and hardship. We don't need comfort. We don't need riches. We don't need popularity. We don't need sex. We don't need pleasure. We have you. Oh, Father, I pray that you would convince us to believe it, to walk out of here finding you more precious than when we came in. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.